Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show!
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Rafael Medina Virtual Morning Report. Today, our focus will be on rheumatology, and for this, we have two amazing guests. As a cases guest, we have Dr. Sarah Gottman, who is a rheumatologist at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Rheumatology Clinic and at the UCSF Vasculitis Clinic, where she is the associate director. She has a clinical focus on systemic vasculitis and antiphospholipid syndrome and is the associate director of the UCSF Rheumatology Fellowship and a senior associate program director in the UCSF Internal Medicine Residency, where she focuses on subspecialty education. She also holds multiple leadership roles in medical education at UCSF, where she is the associate chief of education in the Division of Rheumatology. And as a case presenter, we have Dr. John Landefeld, who is an internist and medical educator at Sacramento County Public Health and an assistant clinical professor at UC Davis Health. And he was previously an internal medicine resident at UCSF and at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. And before we jump into the case, I would like to ask both of you, why did you choose your subspecialty you're in and what you like to do outside of medicine?
I'm happy to start, and I will update John's bio to say that he has now returned to UCSF and is a rheumatology fellow with us here. So we're super excited to have him back. But thanks for having us. We're really excited to be here and get to talk about rheumatology. I chose rheumatology by accident. So when I started my internal medicine training, I thought I wanted to be an interventional cardiologist. And then I happened to do a rheumatology elective as a second year resident and really just fell in love with it. I met so many mentors and teachers that are colleagues now and really love the mix of very interesting subspecialty medicine with getting to do what I think are the best parts of being a general internist as well. Outside of work, I love spending time with my family. So I have three little girls and love playing outside, playing soccer with them, and just enjoying family time. I'll turn it over to John.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. And it's really exciting to be here today just to share this case with you all. Like Sarah mentioned, I used to be, after residency, was a general internist in Sacramento, but the call of rheumatology pulled me back to training. So I'm really excited to be a fellow currently. And for me, rheumatology was a love that really was born out of the clinical cases and the mentors and the attendings, the clinicians that I worked with during my medical school and residency, and seeing just incredible cases that lit my fire for internal medicine and then also rheumatology as well. So it's the combination of the culture of intellectual curiosity and the clinical cases and the patients, coupled with the longitudinal experiences with patients that I love. Outside of work, I love spending time with my family as well and being outdoors as much as possible. So hiking, swimming, whatever, with family or with friends.
Thank you so much for being here. And we are also so excited for having rheumatology as a subspecialty. And then I would like to ask you, Dr. John, are you ready to start off with the first aliquot?
All right. Well, why don't we take it away? So I'm going to start with the case. And our patient today is a 74-year-old woman. She has a history of migraines, meningiomas, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and a remote history of endometrial cancer, presenting with a headache. So 2 months prior to her presentation, after a long day at the beach, this patient developed a new headache that was different from her previous migraines. It was dull, was predominantly on the right side of her head and neck, and it was constant, 6 out of 10 in severity. She had not had any head trauma and cannot recall anything else abnormal about the day or so preceding the onset of the headache. So at first, she thought this was just a different presentation of her migraines. So she took sumatriptan and then aspirin, acetaminophen, and caffeine, which had been prescribed to her in the past. These medications used to help her with her migraines. They did not help with this new headache. She then reached out to her neurosurgery team because she's had this history of meningiomas and was concerned that maybe the headaches were related to this. They ordered an MRI, which was performed 2 weeks after the onset of the headaches, and it showed a right frontal lobe meningioma and a left tentorial meningioma, both of which were thought to be essentially unchanged from 2 years previously. 1 month before this current presentation with us, she presented to an emergency room for evaluation of the headache, received IV dexamethasone, prochlorperazine, diphenhydramine, and ketorolac. And she says she felt somewhat better after receiving these medications. She then met with her primary care provider, who consulted with a headache specialist they knew, and that provider prescribed 10 milligrams of dexamethasone for 10 days. So now several weeks later, in the days leading up to our current presentation, she reported progressive diffuse headaches. She came into urgent care for these symptoms, had labs ordered, but then after going home, developed chills and jaw pain, so came into the emergency room. And I'll pause there.
Amazing. So I see we have a pretty enriching aliquot, and seeing the chief complaint is being headache. So Dr. Sarah, do you have any approach for headache? And then, especially when you talk about headache, are there any signals that you say that there are some red flags?
Yeah, of course. So I think kind of taking a step back and approaching a patient with a new headache, it's important, you know, to keep a broad differential, even in a patient who has a previously diagnosed history of some sort of headache syndrome, right? So we know that this patient has migraines, but she's now presenting with a different type of headache in terms of the character of the pain and the location of the pain. And so important to think, kind of start from square one and think about what are the things that could be causing a headache in this patient. And so, you know, I mean, I kind of think about primary headache syndromes as one category of new headache in a patient. I think about, could this patient have a malignancy causing a headache, especially in someone who is in her 70s, who has a diagnosis previously of endometrial cancer, would be considering either, you know, kind of recurrence of that cancer with potential metastases to the brain as a possibility. It also has, from a non-malignant tumor standpoint, has a known meningioma, so it was appropriately evaluated for possible progression of that lesion to see if it was causing her headache. Thinking about traumatic etiologies of headache, of which she has no history of trauma, to explain that. Thinking about vascular pathology, so, you know, in somebody with a new onset severe headache, thinking about aneurysmal rupture. Infectious etiologies, so things like meningitis, especially of all causes, can cause headaches. But again, we're not getting a history or other risk factors of for infections or other infectious symptoms. And then I'll finish with rheumatology. You know, I won't anchor on that yet, but certainly there are different rheumatic diseases that can cause headaches through a variety of different processes. So kind of we think about the prototypic one being giant cell arteritis, which is a large vessel vasculitis that can affect the temporal arteries and cause headaches. But there are other diseases too. So sometimes our diseases can affect the pachymeninges or the lining of the brain, and that can lead to headaches. People can get aseptic meningitis as a sequela of autoimmune diseases, which can lead to headaches. So at this point, my differential is broad. There are certainly red flags that this is not related to her known headache syndrome, as I said. So new location, new character of a headache, lack of relief with things that had previously aborted her migraines in the past, all in my mind would warrant the further workup that she's had.
Thank you so much for this explanation. Another question would be, we see that this is a profuse headache with jaw pain. Is there something that you would associate with jaw pain?
Yeah, so, you know, definitely people can have primary headache syndromes and have jaw pain as part of that. When I think about jaw pain and headache together as a rheumatologist, I wonder about something called jaw claudication, which is different than just constant jaw pain. Okay, so jaw claudication happens as a result of ischemia to the muscles that are involved in chewing. So people typically won't have pain in their jaw at rest, but as they are chewing something that's tough, you know, it's like if you think about chewing a tougher piece of meat and all the muscle energy that goes into doing that activity, when people have vasculitis of the vessels that feed those muscles, they get relative ischemia with prolonged use. And so they will develop this jaw claudication. So the way that I ask about this is exactly that. Do you have pain or fatigue in your jaw area that develops only after a period of time of kind of doing an activity like chewing with your jaw, not present at rest usually?
Thank you so much. And regarding this case, what could be the red flags in this specific case right here?
I guess just to clarify the question, red flags for the headache itself or red flags for a specific diagnosis?
For headache.
Yeah. So I think in this specific case, I would say the patient's age, the patient's history of cancer that I would be interested in learning more about to know how remote or near term was that diagnosis. The fact that although she has migraines, the quality and location of the headache is different. And then also wondering about this jaw pain, although I would want to know more information to know, is that truly a red flag or is that just kind of part of the headache pain that she's having? And it's interesting that she had improvement with steroids, but I'll say that's nonspecific. There are many types of headaches that will get better with treatment with steroids. So I wouldn't anchor on that to say, oh, this must be an inflammatory cause of headache per se.
Thank you so much. Then Dr. Jung, would you like to start with the next aliquot?
Absolutely. So I'll describe a little bit about her past migraines. So they tended to be left-sided, associated with photophobia, were accompanied by nausea and relieved by sumatriptan, as we talked about. She used to need to utilize that abortive therapy at least 4 times a week. So these were regular and problematic for her. For this current presentation, she also had some associated symptoms. So I talked about the jaw pain. She described it as it felt like her jaw was on fire. She wasn't able to eat because of it, but wasn't having any tongue tingling, wasn't having any difficulty swallowing. She also described that in addition to sort of that pain in the jaw, when she felt tenderness on the head as well, around her eyes, on her cheeks, and across the crown of the head too. At home, when she'd had these chills, she checked her temperature and her temperature was 101 degrees before coming into the emergency room. She was not having any muscle pain, not having any weakness. And she completed that course of dexamethasone prescribed by her PCP 4 days prior to coming into the emergency room. In terms of her past medical history, we've talked about her migraines, her meningiomas. She does have this history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis with an elevated TPO, but a normal TSH. She has this history of endometrial cancer, which was 20 years ago and treated with a hysterectomy and salpingo-oophorectomy, osteopenia, depression, hypertension, and GERD. The surgical history was just for that hysterectomy that I'd mentioned. She has no known drug allergies. In terms of medications, so the sumatriptan and the aspirin, Tylenol, caffeine combination for headaches, she takes pravastatin, candesartan, topiramate, and trazodone. In terms of a family history, her mother had a history of refractory headaches, but she's unclear about what diagnosis or treatment that entailed. No known family history of autoimmune disease. And for her social history, she continues to work part-time as a management consultant. Until last year, she spent time volunteering in a prison. She does not use tobacco, recreational drugs, and drinks 3 to 4 glasses of wine per week. Would you like me to pause or go into the exam next?
I think we can pause right here, and then I would ask Dr. Sarah, is there anything that gives you signal for this case or helps you to narrow down your differential?
I think at this point, I'm just looking here at all that great information. I think at this point that the differential is definitely still broad. As I look at the additional information that John just gave me, I think the description of her jaw pain is interesting. So it's not like it doesn't sound like a classic claudication history, but the fact that she's unable to eat sounds like completely is definitely a red flag for me that there may be some ischemia causing that symptom that she's reporting. She also has reports at least some constitutional symptoms. So she has a fever, she's having chills. And so thinking about some sort of systemic inflammation, whether it be infectious or non-infectious inflammation as part of this syndrome is something that I'm thinking about. As I look at the additional information that I got in the past medical history, so I think the fact that her endometrial cancer diagnosis was so remote, treated only with a surgical procedure, makes it in my mind much less likely that that something related to that cancer is causing her current syndrome. But certainly, you know, the imaging was also helpful in helping to exclude any concern for metastatic disease. And yeah, I think that's all at this point.
Thank you so much. Then Dr. John, would you like to give us the next aliquot?
Perfect. Yeah, so we'll jump into the physical exam now. So on presentation, her vital signs found a temperature of 36.7 degrees centigrade, a heart rate of 80, a respiratory rate of 16, and a blood pressure of 124 over 63 millimeters of mercury. And she was saturating 97% on room air. In general, she was well appearing. She was laying on the bed in no distress. Her HVENT exam found no conjunctival injection, no scleral icterus. There were no rashes or ulcers on the face or in the oropharynx. There was tenderness to palpation just lateral to the eyes. It seemed like right more than left. There was no cervical or supraclavicular lymphadenopathy. Her cardiovascular exam was found a regular rate and rhythm, no murmurs, no rubs or gallops. She had 2+ radial pulses, no lower extremity edema, no carotid or subclavian bruise. Her chest exam was clear to auscultation throughout. Her GI exam, her abdomen was soft and non-tender. There was no organomegaly. Her skin exam found no rashes, normal nails, no alopecia. Her neurologic exam, she had 5 out of 5 strength distally and proximally in both the upper and lower extremities. Her cranial nerves 2 through 12 were intact, and sensation was intact to light touch throughout the extremities. She had no joint tenderness or swelling throughout the upper and lower extremities.
Okay. Then I would ask you, Dr. Sarah, is there anything that helps you with this case so far? And another question would be, with this whole case presentation right now, what would be your general workup as a rheumatologist?
Yeah. So just looking at her exam so far, so the things that jump out to me are the fact that she is tender to palpation, it sounds like over the temporal area where she's reporting her headache. So that is notable. It's not a specific enough finding to make a diagnosis at this point of giant cell arteritis or temporal arteritis, but it's certainly something that I am paying attention to. When I'm thinking about the possibility of giant cell arteritis as the cause of her headache, I'm also really paying attention to doing a careful vascular exam. And so assessing for pulses throughout, doing a careful exam for bruise in the neck, throughout the chest, and the abdomen as well, and in the iliac arteries. Again, kind of just looking for evidence of vascular abnormalities elsewhere that help build a case for that diagnosis. And I would also want to check for extremity blood pressures in a patient in whom I was considering giant cell arteritis for that same reason. So often people with giant cell arteritis have disease in the temporal arteries, but can also have involvement of the large vessels in the chest and the abdomen. And so you may find blood pressure differentials, again, that are helpful in kind of moving your diagnostic reasoning forward. I'm also wondering, and John, you may have said this and I missed it, but just wondering, I know she didn't have any visual changes. Is that right? Any visual symptoms?
That's right. No visual changes.
Okay, great. So if she had had any visual symptoms at all, it would be very important for her to have a careful fundoscopic exam done as part of this evaluation. I think given that she has 0 visual symptoms, it's you know, going to be lower yield in terms of next steps diagnostically. And then I think, Seema, your second question is how I would approach things from a diagnostic standpoint at this point in the case. And so I think there is certainly enough here to, number one, warrant further workup of her headache, and number two, further workup giant cell arteritis specifically. And so she had had an MRI done already 2 weeks ago, right? Okay. So the first thing I would do is I would just start with some basic labs. So looking again for signs of systemic inflammation, getting a CBC with DIF, and also inflammatory markers and ESR and CRP. So Those are all nonspecific, as I know that you all know, but they are helpful if they're normal. So if her SED rate, for example, is completely normal, the chance that she has giant cell arteritis is extremely low. It's not impossible. About 5 to 10% of people with GCA can have an ESR of less than 40, but it's really uncommon. So that would be step number one. Step number two would probably be more imaging of her brain. And in this case, we would be getting the MRI not to look for parenchymal problems because she already had that MRI 2 weeks ago that didn't show anything. I'm more interested in vascular imaging at this point. And at some places, you can get a special type of MR angiogram that looks specifically at the scalp vessels. And it has a great negative predictive value. So again, if it's negative and the patient has not been on steroids, that's a caveat, then you can, in many circumstances, completely rule out the possibility of giant cell arteritis. If it's positive, then they still need to go on to have further diagnostic workup done because things like atherosclerosis in the temporal arteries can also cause an abnormal MR of the scalp vessel. But I would start with that MRA and then make a decision from there as to whether or not she needed, you know, something like a temporal artery biopsy, or recognizing that this is definitely an international audience, which is great. There are many places in the world where getting an ultrasound of the temporal arteries and or of the axillary arteries is the gold standard for making the diagnosis of giant cell arteritis. So I think I would, you know, consider what the resources and expertise were at the place where I was practicing. But at UCSF and at most places in the United States still, there's not a lot of expertise in vascular ultrasound for the diagnosis of giant cell arteritis.
Thank you so much for all these pearls. Another question that came up to me is, we see that she has also volunteered to work in prison before. And when we think of headaches that can also mimic GCA, do you think that there could be something else also going on right now?
Yeah, that's great. And I think, considering the possibility of, could this patient have tuberculous meningitis causing a headache, right? And being the cause of her symptoms and, you know, not something that's non-infectious at all. I think it's a great consideration. I missed how kind of what her actual exposure to the prison system had been. I know she volunteered there, but I don't know like how long ago she was last exposed. And then thinking about, has she had TB screening done on a regular basis? Has that ever been positive? And then certainly if she had anything on her MRI, because many of those patients will have pecky meningitis as well, would pursue further workup for that.
Thank you so much. Then Dr. Jung, would you start with the next aliquot, please?
Sure. And I'll just to respond to that question about a little bit more of the social history. So she had volunteered monthly in prisons for over a decade, but last 1 to 2 years ago, doing teaching with people there, and had irregularly had TB screening. Never has it been positive, however. So in terms of an initial lab workup, so CBC was sent that found a white blood cell count of 7.4, a hemoglobin of 11.7 and 240,000 platelets. The differential was normal on that CBC. For her BMP, her sodium was 140, potassium 4.3, chloride 109, bicarb 23, BUN 22, creatinine was 1.06 and glucose 102. Her calcium was 9.1, her total protein was 6.8 and her albumin was 3.1. Her LFTs found an AST of 16, an ALT of 15, ALK-FOS of 81, and a T-Billy of 0.2. Her TSH was 1.6, her ESR was 34, and her CRP was 66.2. Her EKG was normal sinus rhythm. There was minimal voltage criteria for LVH, non-specific ST and T-wave abnormalities that when compared to a previous EKG from a year prior was not significantly changed.
Okay, starting here, is there anything in the labs that helps you here right now?
Yeah, and John, I missed the ESR. What did you say it was?
34.
34, okay. So I think the main thing that I notice when I look at her labs is that overall they look quite normal, with the exception of her CRP. So her ESR is normal, although in some labs that will flag as elevated. based on this patient's age, an ESR of 34 is completely normal, but her CRP is elevated and fairly significantly so. You know, again, not a specific test at all, not a diagnostic test, but she does, again, kind of have increasing signs of systemic inflammation. So it's helpful to see that as we think about, you know, the possibility of giant cell arteritis or other inflammatory causes of her syndrome. One thing I'll just comment on that is kind of a funny thing that we sometimes see in giant cell arteritis is that in about 25% of patients, they'll have an elevated alkaline phosphatase. I noticed hers was normal and certainly, you know, doesn't rule out the diagnosis at all, but just a little pearl to share with the group. I think that's all. So I would say, kind of looking at this information as a whole, it doesn't help me all that much in terms of making a more specific diagnosis, but it does provide one more piece of information that I should be concerned about giant cell arteritis in addition to, you know, other inflammatory causes.
Thank you so much. And I also wanted to appreciate the pearl that you mentioned with the elevated alkaline phosphatase and GCA, because I also recently read about Takayasu arteritis where alkaline phosphatase can also be elevated. I wanted to ask you, is there any explanation why the alkaline phosphatase is being elevated?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say, I don't think the exact answer or pathophysiology is understood. I have read that there may be, and I think this is a very, you know, waving our hands, but relative ischemia to some of the bile ducts due to the vasculitis that can be like kind of in or around the liver, and that may drive that elevation, but we really aren't sure. You do see it normal in people who have that elevation. It does normalize with immunosuppressive treatment, suggesting that there's, you know, some inflammatory process that's driving it, but we don't really have a great answer, or I don't have a great answer. At least somebody may have a great answer, but not me.
Thank you so much. And we also see that her albumin is quite low in contrast to her total protein. Would you say that this is due to this inflammatory state that she is in, or how would you explain it?
Yeah, that's a great point that someone made. So thank you for picking up on that. You know, I mean, I kind of think about albumin in many cases as going in the kind of being the negative acute phase reactant, right? So it often tends to drop in states of subacute to chronic inflammation. And so, you know, maybe this is another piece of evidence of an inflammatory process.
And seeing that the ESR is 34, just wanted to recap, in how many percent of people that present with giant cell arteritis, for example, the ESR is being not high?
Yeah. So in the studies that have looked at this, and there have not really been recently updated studies of this, but about 10% of patients who are ultimately diagnosed with giant cell arteritis will have an ESR at initial presentation before treatment of 50, and about 5% will have an ESR of less than 40. And many of those studies didn't report on concomitant CRP elevation. And so I think that's something, you know, just to consider. I think the likelihood of a patient having both a low ESR and a CRP at the same time is probably even lower than those numbers that I just quoted you. And I think in this patient's case, it's potentially a little bit confounded by the fact that she's been on and off at least a couple courses of steroids. So I think it just, you know, something to keep in mind as we're trying to interpret these numbers.
Thank you so much. Dr. John, would you like to give us the next aliquot?
Absolutely. So for all the reasons that Sarah had mentioned, an MRI and MRA of the brain were performed and with limited sequences per this temporal arteritis protocol. And this image found that there's slight asymmetric multifocal mural enhancement without thickening involving the right temporal artery when compared to the left. There was no acute hemorrhage, no herniation, no reduced diffusion. There were unchanged meningiomas, as described previously, and no abnormal parenchymal, leptomeningeal, or dural enhancement. The ventricles were within normal size for her age. So in terms of an impression, this was asymmetric slight mural enhancement without thickening involving the right temporal artery that was thought to be likely physiologically normal, but could represent early temporal arteritis in this patient with a localized right temporal headache.
So Dr. Sarah, what would you make out of this information right now?
So this is helpful. So as I said, when we get these scans, really the purpose of them is to rule out giant cell arteritis if they're negative. So if you have a patient in whom you have a low to low to moderate probability of disease, having a negative MRA is very helpful. And you really can, in most cases, be done with your workup for giant cell arteritis and say that that patient does not have giant cell arteritis. In a scenario like this, where you have an abnormal MRA showing these abnormalities in the temporal artery, further workup is needed. Because if you look at the studies that have assessed these scans in someone who has an abnormal MRA, only about 50% of those patients will end up having a diagnosis of giant cell arteritis. So the positive predictive value is not very good, right? It's like a coin toss. So you need to go on and do something else to make a diagnosis, but it should prompt, you know, next steps in terms of workup. And as I said, at our institution, the next step that I would recommend for this patient would be a temporal artery biopsy. The other thing to know is that these abnormalities on imaging can go away very quickly with the use of steroids. So often within 2 to 3 days, if you image somebody right after that, their MRA will be normal. And so you just want to be, you want to be interpreting the results of a negative scan in the context of whether or not they have recently gotten treatment with steroids for any reason. But here we, you know, she had been on and off steroids. We have an abnormal scan and a concerning clinical story. So plenty of information to warrant further workup for this patient.
Thanks a lot. We would be also curious to know, what are your current differential diagnoses at the moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say that at this point, I have a high concern for giant cell arteritis. Obviously, I'm a rheumatologist and, you know, I'm being presented this case in a morning report. And so I'm certainly biased by that. But I think there's a lot of concerning history here and now lab and imaging findings that in my mind are really raising that to the top of my differential diagnosis at this point. The other thing I'll say is that there are other types of systemic vasculitis that can affect the temporal arteries. It's uncommon, but it does happen. So, you know, certain types of small vessel vasculitis, like ANCA-associated vasculitis, can sometimes affect the temporal arteries. So I would be thinking about the possibilities of those as well. I think the other thing on my differential would be thinking about infectious mimickers. So, for example, I have seen neurosyphilis as a great mimic for giant cell arteritis. So kind of going back, thinking about, does this patient have any risk factors for syphilis or other vascular tropic infections that I may have missed kind of the first time around, and either, you know, asking more questions or doing more specific serologic testing if that were indicated based on the history or the exam. And then I think the other kind of like the third group on my differential would be, could these imaging findings be unrelated to her headache, right? So maybe she just has atherosclerosis in these vessels and that's what's causing these MRA to be abnormal, but there's something else entirely causing her headache. You know, could she have a new primary headache syndrome that I will not pretend to be an expert in as a non-neurologist, but I'm kind of thinking about that differential too.
Thank you so much. Then I was also going to have another question regarding the treatment, because we still know the differential is still broad, but would you start her on steroids at the moment? Because seeing she doesn't have any visual symptoms, so that was like quite curious to me. What would you do with this patient right now?
Yeah, so I would start her on steroids at this point in time. Now that I have a concerning history, I have the elevated C-reactive protein and I have the abnormal MRA, you know, my pretest probability is high enough to start her on empiric steroids for the possibility of giant cell arteritis. When I think about that decision, I'm thinking about what are the risks to leaving this patient untreated if she does have giant cell arteritis while we go on with further workup. And the risks are high, right? So we worry about irreversible vision loss if this were to go untreated, which can happen in about 15 to 20% of patients if you don't treat them promptly. So that informs this decision. The other thing that informs this decision is understanding what are the potential impacts on a temporal artery biopsy and decreasing my diagnostic yield if I start her on prednisone now versus waiting for that biopsy to happen. The yield starts to decrease in the biopsy after about 2 weeks on high-dose steroids, but it's still possible to make a diagnosis in many cases at that time. And so I would start her on prednisone. I would, you know, depending on kind of the clinical setting, either have her, you know, stay and get a temporal artery biopsy that next day or have an, you know, urgent referral for that to be done in the outpatient setting. So making sure that it's expedited, but I wouldn't wait to treat.
Thank you so much. And Dr. John, would you like to give us the next aliquot, please?
Absolutely. So, you know, as we've heard, this was enough of a, we had a high enough index of suspicion in this case to begin empiric steroids and were able to arrange for a temporal artery biopsy. The biopsy found sections showing marked mononuclear inflammation with rare giant cells infiltrating all three layers of the artery wall, a significant amount of granulomatous inflammation involving the tunica adventitia, less prominent inflammation in the tunica media associated with focal fragmentation and attenuation of the internal elastic lamina. There was intimal fibroplasia and inflammatory cells within the intima. No significant atherosclerosis or alternative forms of vasculitis observed in this specimen. So the final pathologic diagnosis here was giant cell arteritis.
Thank you so much, Dr. John. So Dr. Sarah, what would be your final comments on this case at the moment?
Yeah, so it's nice when everything fits together in this way, as it did for the diagnosis, it sounds like, in this patient. So just looking at this pathology report, you know, it's really very consistent with the diagnosis of giant cell arteritis, as was reported, you know, by the pathologist who interpreted this. And so putting this information together with the rest of the info that we got earlier in the case, this is all really consistent with a diagnosis of GCA. Yeah, John wasn't too hard on me today.
Thank you so much. And there would be another question is whether you could share pitfalls of GCA, because we all want to make sure we don't want to miss a case ever.
Yeah, well, I appreciate not wanting to miss a case. I would say first making sure that you kind of understand that other symptoms that patients can have in addition to headache can be really helpful in assessing for the possibility of GCA. So we talked about some of them today. So one being jaw claudication, if it's present, that's really helpful because it's a very specific symptom for giant cell arteritis. The other thing is actually diplopia. So sometimes patients, it's not all that common, but when it's present, again, it's got good specificity for the diagnosis. Sometimes patients will have diplopia before they develop other visual symptoms. And I think that's something that is probably less recognized. And so people just don't know to ask about it. And it may be relatively transient. And so patients don't necessarily think to report it to you without being prompted by a question. The other thing that we didn't really talk about in this case, because she didn't have symptoms, but would be symptoms of polymyalgia rheumatica. So polymyalgia rheumatica, or PMR, is present in about 50% of patients that have giant cell arteritis. So again, just kind of tucking that away and knowing that if you're concerned about giant cell arteritis, you also want to ask about symptoms of PMR, which is not weakness, but pain and really significant stiffness in the shoulders, often the neck and the hips as well. That's very prominent in the morning and then tends to improve, you know, with gentle activities over the course of the day. So those are some, I think, historical things that can help you in terms of assessing for this diagnosis. Other pitfalls would be just remembering, you know, that the differential for new headache and even new visual symptoms, and often what you'll see on physical exam is an optic neuropathy with optic disc swelling, but the differential for that is broad. And so also not anchoring too quickly on a diagnosis of giant cell arteritis. And I think number three is understanding kind of the power of imaging and helping either exclude the diagnosis or kind of moving you towards more advanced diagnostic.
Thank you so much. And another question would be, what is the diagnostic advantage in the use of temporal artery ultrasonography in this case?
Well, it's a great question. I'll just say I wish at my institution and at many places in the U.S. we had the ability to do temporal artery ultrasonography and had people skilled in it. The truth is that it's a great tool when the people who are doing the scans and interpreting the scans have the expertise to do it. Because when that is the case, you really are able to avoid temporal artery biopsy. So for example, in Europe, if you look at the EULAR guidelines, which is the European League Against Rheumatism, their guidelines are to use temporal artery ultrasonography as the gold standard for diagnosis, and patients do not need a temporal artery biopsy. That is not the case in the United States when you look at the American College of Rheumatology guidelines. And again, that is based solely on kind of lack of experience and lack of expertise of many people here. But hopefully that will change in the future, because it's a great test.
Thank you so much. And management-wise, what would you do with this patient?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would do, as was done for her, is to start her on prednisone. You know, when you start prednisone in these patients, you really can avoid eliminate the risk of them going on to develop vision loss, which is, as I said, the reason for prompt treatment in these patients. And the usual doses that we use is around 40 to 60 milligrams of prednisone to start. And then I would say that many people would also, and I myself included, would start this patient on a medication called tocilizumab, which is an anti-IL-6 medication that is has been shown to be efficacious as a steroid-sparing agent in the treatment of patients that have giant cell arteritis. In the US is FDA approved for that indication. And so knowing that, you know, this is a chronic disease, these patients are elderly, they're at very high risk for complications from chronic steroid use, it's great to have this option that allows us to much more rapidly taper prednisone and dramatically reduce their cumulative prednisone exposure. And so usually we're kind of starting that shortly after we start prednisone, once we kind of jump through the logistical hoops of ordering that medication. It's available either as a subcutaneous injection or as an infusion.
Regarding the tocilizumab use as a glucocorticoid sparing agent, are there other agents that are also being used?
There are, but not as first line therapies for steroids being agents. So there's a little bit of data for methotrexate. I would say that's not widely used, though, because in clinical practice, it really has not panned out as being very helpful for most patients as a steroid sparing medication. There are many clinical trials going on looking at other agents, but at this point, there's nothing else that has been shown to be effective beyond tocilizumab.
Thank you. And do we now routinely start interleukin-6 blockage for a new diagnosis of PMR, or how is it?
That's a great question. So I would say no, not routinely yet for PMR. I would say it's becoming more routine for giant cell arteritis. And again, there's still a lot of variability from country to country based on what is available in a specific place. But I would say in many places, it is routine for giant cell arteritis. PMR is a different decision. So right now in the United States, there is a trial or a medication called sarilumab, which is also another IL-6 blocker, that has been shown to be effective in the treatment of PMR. But it's still early days, I would say, for that medication. That trial actually has only been presented. It hasn't been published. And so it's not in widespread use yet. But I expect that we will be moving towards not using steroid monotherapy for PMR patients in the future. We're just not there yet.
Thank you so much for all these pearls. I would also ask you, Dr. John, are there any comments you have regarding this case, your journey for this case?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so a couple. One of the points that I think came up a couple of times in this case is understanding the limitations of our testing. So it was surprising at first blush to see a relatively low normal ESR, but understanding that, you know, medications that patients take, either prescribed or not, sometimes people take things that are purchased over the counter that might have steroids in them and affect the validity of our tests. Likely impacted, you know, the steroids in this case likely impacted that SED rate, and then probably also the MR. And then, you know, the MR can also have, like Dr. Godwin mentioned, you know, in advanced, you know, atherosclerotic disease can have luminal narrowing that might actually be mistaken for vasculitis depending on the quality of the MRI as well. And then, you know, moving on to the temporal artery biopsy, making sure that we get a good sample. You know, a small sample may be negative, but as long as it's, you know, 2 centimeters or longer, as was in this case, you're likely to have had enough tissue to really, you know, get a good look looking for the vasculitis. So that's one. And then the other, you know, I think this is a disease of folks who are older, right? And so, you know, so many of our patients who are older are also going to be the folks who are most at risk for high dose glucocorticoid therapy, which traditionally GCA would call for, you know, 6 months to a year of high doses of prednisone. And so thinking early about those steroid sparing agents and making sure that you're, you know, doing different sorts of, you know, testing for TB and other medications that you'd need to consider before starting the tocilizumab in this case, which we did. And because I think it's always helpful to hear a little bit about how the patient's doing as well. So, you know, she's now on tocilizumab, is doing, you know, much better, has not had any recurrence of symptoms, and has sort of returned to her prior level of functioning.
Thank you so much for all these pearls and also for having presented this case. I would now head the mic to Dr. Sarah to share her favorite teaching points from the session for all the listeners out there.
Yeah. Okay. It's a lot of pressure. I'm trying to think of three highest yield for everybody. I mean, I think the first one is that if you suspect giant cell arteritis, recognizing that, you know, there is a relatively high risk of vision loss if it is left untreated, you should have a low threshold to start that patient on empiric treatment and make sure that you have a plan for diagnostic steps going forward, because you are committing this patient to prolonged, you know, prednisone at some doses and potentially another medication once you've made that diagnosis. And so, you know, try not to fall into the trap of being worried about it, starting the prednisone, and then kind of just like sending the patient on their way and hoping that like that temporal artery biopsy happens at some point. You really need to make sure that there's a proactive plan for that to happen soon, ideally within 2 weeks, so that you can make a definitive diagnosis. I think another teaching point to emphasize here is kind of recognizing all of the other symptoms that patients with giant cell arteritis may have. So, you know, we often talk a lot, understandably, about a new onset headache in an elderly person being concerning for giant cell arteritis. But remembering what we talked about today in terms of screening for any new visual symptoms, jaw claudication, symptoms of PMR, and then on your exam, doing a careful vascular exam for pulses and Bruis, looking for Bruis that shouldn't be there and asymmetric pulses or asymmetric blood pressures. And then I think finally, a major learning point here is the role of imaging that continues to advance in helping us make the diagnosis of giant cell arteritis. So we spent a lot of time talking about how we use and interpret the results of MR angiography in these patients. And then also I shared my jealousy of not having access to temporal artery and axillary artery ultrasound that many of you do, which is really important for these patients.
Thank you so much for all these pearls. I've learned so much and the listeners out there will too. So thank you so much, Dr. John and Dr. Sarah. We hope to see you in another VMR soon. And then I would end this session and we'll say goodbye to everyone.
Bye. Thank you so much for having us. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.